This is Doug Allen, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 19th of June 2011. Doug Allen, Part 1.
My name is Doug Allen, and I was born on the 17th of July 1951 in Dunfermline in Scotland.
And what about your parents? What were they up to?
My father was a photographer and a freelance cameraman for BBC Scotland and various other people. My mother was initially looked after me and my brothers and sisters. I'm one of five. I've got one twin brother, one younger brother, two younger sisters. So mother was more or less a housewife, you know, for all of those. But then she also went into business. She was also helping dad with his business. And then they also set up a hairdressing business, latterly. But father had a very successful freelance photography journalist business until he, unfortunately, had... He had a car accident about 1972-73, and that broke his leg rather badly, and he was a long time off work, and it did leave him rather unable to be as active as he was beforehand. But then he became a producer with Fife Educational Television Service, which back in those days, Fife was rather ahead of the game, really. They would record with the BBC and people's permission, they would record programmes off the television, and then they had a system within Fife schools for sending those programmes out so that schools could look at them any time they wanted. And they also produced short 10-15 minute pieces about local people and sometimes some celebrities. I remember he made a programme for the schools about Patrick Moore, for example. And he also interviewed Bing Crosby when Bing came over to play a celebrity golf match. And, of course, typically being Maurice Allen, it was my sister Judy, who was at school at the time, who interviewed Bing for the school's programme. And then there was also the spin-off of, here's Judy Allen interviews Bing Crosby. Oh, we'll send that to the local papers as well. So he was very sharp. And I may have what I do now with the wildlife filming and all the irons that I have to have in the fire. I think I probably get some of that from Dad.
Did you at any time help him with his business?
I did go on one or two. I did help him out with one or two shoots, just carrying, gophering, so to speak. And then much later on, I did cover one wedding for him. And I have to say that a wedding, stills photography for a wedding, is probably the scariest thing I've ever done. I mean, you know, these people are... It's the day of their lives and you are charged with making a record of it. And this is before digital, so it's all film. So you have to take it and hope for the best in a way. And I don't know if I could do it as he did. He used to do two and three in a day and would turn them round. He would go shoot it, take the photographs, then they would whiz back to the shop, get the film, with his assistant would get the film, process it, run off some proofs, some prints. Then mother would take them all down to the reception. And the secret was, if you got all the family plus the friends and relatives at the reception, you got many more orders for prints than you would if you waited till later in the week. But it was a hell of a turnaround because you had three weddings, get in there, get the groups, get the fancy shots, and then get down to the reception that afternoon or evening and pick up the orders. So I don't think I was aware at the time just how hard they worked and how slick they were. The sort of memories I have of the dreaded end of the month till slips, where they would go through these endless rolls on which all the transactions in the shop had been recorded, and that was what you had to tally your books at the end of the month. And I remember how long it used to take. And father had this. He had this, I think, frustrating habit of mum would do the books and they might not balance up. And she would spend a lot of time wondering about it. And then she would say, Maurice, they're not balancing. And he would say, yeah, check the 17th of July, order so-and-so. I think maybe I didn't put that one in. And sure enough, that missing order would make it all balance.
So was there a certain inevitability that you would end up working with film and camera?
I don't think so, to be honest. I don't know. I don't know where I got my creative streak in a way. I mean, it's great to work in the same sort of field as Dad, and we still talk about it, and I think he's obviously happy with the way I've gone. But I have to say, we did go in quite different directions, because with me, diving was the first love, then biology, and the photography actually came last of all. An interest in photography actually came last of all. And it really took off, even when I'd left university, it took off probably in the Red Sea, when I started taking some underwater photographs. But then the photography really took off in the first year that I was in the Antarctic, when I went to Cygni. And it was so obvious. I went in there with very, very modest camera. Hadn't really thought about the photography. But it was obvious that people were very good and very keen on base. And I picked up a lot of the basics, you know, in that first year. And that was kind of where it got the bug. And especially, I think I wanted to... Photographs were the only way that I knew I could capture underwater, definitely. And it was very much in my mind after the first winter that I'm going to go back down again, and I'm going to go down not just to work for bass, but with some good stills gear and come back with a good underwater record.
But we'll pick up that again shortly. It doesn't matter if we dodge about a bit.
No, at all.
But I'm wondering where the diving came from.
I think I was a child of the 60s, so to speak, and I don't know where, I'm not quite sure where the adventurous streak came from, but I do know that my parents, loving though they are and were and still are, if they had a fault, it was to not realise that me and Ron, my twin brother, were actually quite different people. We were always lumped together as the twins, and we were always compared one to the other. And whereas, in fact, Ron and I, our talents actually lie in very different directions. And I think if we'd been given the opportunity or encouragement or what have you, and this is partly schools, it's partly the folks, it's partly just the culture, the climate of the time. But if we'd been given the encouragement to go our separate ways, I think school might have been very different. And diving, in a way, was... I remember, it sounds cliched, but The Silent World, Jacques Cousteau, I think that was published for something like 57. But my father was he used to get these Reader's Digest condensed books, where once a month you got four books, the best of. And I do distinctly remember we had a collection of them on the wall, and I can't remember when I first read The Silent World in the condensed version. It was probably when I was maybe 12 or 13. And something definitely clicked, and it was just something adventurous about it, but also it was a non-competitive sport. I used to play rugby, I used to play cricket and all that kind of thing, and had a great time and often played in the same team as Ron, but I wasn't quite as good or quite as keen for the sort of success. But on the other hand, there was something mysterious and adventurous and romantic, I have to say, about the underwater world. And in the 60s, the two big frontiers were space and underwater. And if you couldn't go into space, underwater was a pretty good second bet. And Cousteau was coming through on the television, Hans Haas was punching through. And I don't remember how much these things impressed me, but I do remember we were also one of the lucky families who were quite early to take advantage of cheap package deal holidays. Well, comparatively cheap. Not they weren't as cheap as they were now. But I remember Father, because he worked hard, him and Mum worked hard, and all days of... You know, Sundays were nothing special. You might get called out on a job. And we had a couple of very... They weren't disastrous, but we had a couple of Scottish holidays where it just rained all the time. And I remember Father saying, look, you know, I want a holiday where I can go and guarantee the sun. So when 63, 64, when those package deals came along... Well, they weren't jumbos at all. They were just to Spain and places like that. But I remember them taking advantage of that. And so... when I was probably 12 or 13, we started going to the Mediterranean. And, of course, snorkeling was a calm, warm sea. It just became automatic. I mean, Ron and I were into... we went to gymnastics and things like that. We were quite good at that because our uncle was into that. He was a Scottish champion for a number of years. So we grew up with quite a sporty background, so to speak. And we were both good swimmers, confident in the water. So going to the Med and then just taking a mask and snorkel was... just part of the course.
I remember the Jacques Cousteau television programmes. We were of an age, you and I, They were, of course, in black and white.
They were, yeah. They were, well, until 68. Then they got rescreened, because 68 was when colour came along on BBC Two. And I think, they were rescreened at that point as well. So I just remember, diving just, or being happy, snorkelling, etc. We took to it, both of us, like a fish to water, but I particularly enjoyed it.
When you were watching Jacques Cousteau on television, be it black and white or colour, were you watching it with the cameraman's eye already? Were you thinking, well,
just
if
pure.
Only he'd done that.
No. Photography wasn't even close to it. I think it was just the adventure. I think somewhere I've always been. I think from an early age, this sort of being linked with Ron and being compared with him subconsciously and almost being linked with him has gave me a strong sense of contrariness and a strong sense of wanting to be my own person and doing things different. And I'm sure I've done things differently, sometimes due to sheer bloody-mindedness, when it hasn't been maybe the best thing to do. It certainly made me... it just makes you a bit odd. It makes you want to... it's important when you're trying to create your identity as a teenager. And if you get that frustrated, then you often go down a slightly rebellious route.
What's your first memory of being aware that there was such a place as the Antarctic?
When I read an article, it was after I had graduated, to be honest. I remember I graduated, and I've only really made, I think, three decisions in my life. And the rest has followed. The first one was not to do a PhD after my first degree. I got a good enough first degree that I was offered several PhDs, but I wanted one that involved diving, and preferably diving abroad. And none of the ones that I was offered really had that. So I decided to come out of university and give myself a year to maybe find a better PhD. And I was... So that was number one decision. And it was during that year, I think the following year, that was in 1973. In 74, I was running a dive school. No, 75, sorry. I was running a dive school in Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I read this article written by a guy called Ray Townley Mullion, who had been the diving officer on Cygni. And I thought, that sounds pretty interesting. I'll write to Bass. Of course, there wasn't any internet those days, but I did some research. So I wrote into Bass about the diving officer's job and filled in an application form, put in the referees and things. And anyway, I got an interview in the summer of 75. And I remember it was Eric Salmon interviewed me, and I can't remember who else, maybe Martin White. Anyway, so I had the interview, and then and that was really my only knowledge of the Antarctic. I didn't particularly... I probably should have researched more about it before I went in, because I tell you what caught me about the interview. But anyway, a month later, they wrote back and said, no, we haven't given you the job. And I think two things counted against me. Number one was that it was only when I went into the interview that I realised it was a 2.5-year post as opposed to a 1-year post. So it slightly, it's 2.5, slightly phased me. And the other thing they had concerns, which may have been fair enough, was that I might be working with or under or for people who were less well qualified than I was. And they were a little bit, that was something they went into. But anyway, for whatever reason, they didn't get it. I didn't get it. And I remember the letter that said, you haven't got that job, arrived in Jersey on the same day as a letter arrived from a bunch of biologists with whom I had worked the year before in the Red Sea, saying, we've got a job for you in the Red Sea. Would you like to come out here for at least for a few months? So it was great. One door closed, another one. So I thought, well, that's too bad about Bass. Maybe I'll apply again, but we'll see. And then I went out to the Red Sea in September. And I was out there from September, October through to January, February. And the work was finishing that I had to do out there. And a telex arrived from Bass saying, unexpected vacancy on Cygni. Do you want to go? And this was to me in the Red Sea. And it basically said, if you want to go, then you've got to leave in about 3 weeks. So you, wherever you are, we'd like you to come back ASAP because you'll have to go to Cambridge for a week. So this was away from my parents and things, but I had there was a great guy out there called Peter Vine, who was he was a scientist, but he was a real entrepreneur and thought outside the box. And his I remember him saying the thing that changed my life, Doug, he said, was me. I did VSO for a year in the Gilbert and Ellis Islands, away out of anywhere, and it just made me different. He said, you want to get to the Antarctic because this will make you different. This will be great. He was all for it. So I really, so any misgivings I might have had.
So that was decision number two.
That was decision number two. And then decision number three was much further down the line, having had a really good 8-year relationship with Bas. I'm until about 84. I think at that point I was offered rather a BC, or it might have been before Holly. Anyway, there was a possibility of staying with Bas, but going more into the admin summer BC type level. And I decided not to do that. Pardon me. I decided not to do that, but to make a go of wildlife filming, because at that point it all came together. Okay. So those were the only three decisions: not to do a PhD, to go down to Bass in the first place, and then to leave Bass and do wildlife photography afterwards.
Well, I hope this doesn't make it a very short interview.
No.
Let's just go back then, because when you were applying to Bass, how familiar were you with the Antarctic? Had you read about the polar explorers?
No, not at all.
Nothing at all.
Not at all.
Did you know where it was?
Oh, I knew where it was. I mean, I knew it was at South Pole and things. But it just sounded, from the article, like it was a really interesting place to go and dive. And I had been thinking in those 2.5 years that I realised I liked working with scientists. I still love it to this day. The best thing, and it's not a small thing, that my degree has given me is an ability to think the same way as a scientist, to go to any scientist and start talking to them about their project and come up to a level where you're having a good, interesting conversation quickly. So the idea of being down in the Antarctic and diving underneath the ice in this small group and all that sort of thing, it really appealed to me, because I'd been in small groups and with scientists in the Red Sea and found that very stimulating. And so it just, as I say, it appealed to me. I can't remember how I found out about Bass in those days. I must have written to them to get the application form in the first place, and they must have sent some information back. But I don't remember being, very well prepared. And that's the other thing, I've only ever had one interview in my life, and I failed it. It's ironic that when they gave me, when I got the chance, that it all clicked so well.
Yeah.
And I really,
did they ever find out why they turned you down?
No, not really. Yeah. Apart from, I think it was maybe misgivings about whether I'd fit in having a degree like already. And maybe they thought, maybe he's, not quite ready for the 2.5 years.
So it must have been a fairly hectic 3 to 4 weeks between leaving the Red Sea, coming back to Britain and sailing south.
Yeah. Well, I didn't sail south, flew south.
Had the ship already gone?
This was right at the end of the season. I was contacted in, I think, middle of February or something, or towards the end of February in the Red Sea, and then I came back and I went to Cambridge for a week.
So you missed the conference?
I missed the conference, didn't do anything. I went down with, I flew down to Punta and got on the Bisco, and I think it was Bisco, was it Brani? Whatever ship it was the last ship.
I think
call.
It was the Banshee.
Okay, it was the last ship call. So literally we arrived on Signy in the morning, and I think she left the next day. And that was it for the winter.
So you'd had no crevasse rescue?
No. We picked up all that. The guys were really good on base. But I do remember being pretty... I wasn't as fully aware as I might have been about how careful you have to be, going into base. And things that look odd are quite natural, etc. The guys looked after me, really well. And I fitted in quite quickly, but I took over from John Hall. John Hall had come down from, he was the diving officer on South G, and the diving officer on Signy, who was a guy called Dave Marsh, I think, he left halfway through the season. John came in, took over from him, got things kind of organised, and I had a 24-hour changeover with John Hall.
And what were you diving for? This wasn't just to take photographs, was it?
No, this was the standard Signy diving officer's role. So you looked after the equipment on base, which was pretty simple, to be honest. We had some twin hose demand valves and some single cylinders. You looked after, we had a one-man recompression chamber at that point, so you would test that every month. You'd look after the gear, service it, He'd look after the diving records. Basically, you were there to help the scientists get their work done as efficiently as they could. It was also a very free and easy policy about teaching people to dive. People, if they came down to Sydney, they didn't have to have a medical before they came. If they wanted to learn to dive, we might tell Cambridge or we might just get on with it. And people, and I taught, I think it wasn't that year, but the next time I went down, everybody on base learned to dive. And we would go, sometimes we would make dives for a very scientific purpose, but there was a lot of interest I was interested in just going along taking photographs of things, and so were some of the other people. So, I mean, I think in that year, let's say roughly 76 into 77, the winter and the summer, let's say we did about 220 dives. Probably about half of them were scientific and necessary, and the other ones were, let's go and take some photographs, or let's go and check out this site because we're not quite sure what's there. And so you're just gathering the database, because diving only started in Sydney intensively in 68, I think. So there was a lot known about Borish Bay and the immediate environs, but there was a lot of chances to go and look at some other places.
Sometimes, so how far afield were you getting?
How far off did we go? Well, once we went across the Coronation, I remember in the summer we took... it was also... That was the year when they got... I think it was the first year that summer, they got a boat, a decent-sized launch. Prior to that, they'd been using either inflatables or small dories. But they got a launch which had a little cabin on it and was a bit more seaworthy. And I remember in the summer of 76 and 77, we went across to Coronation Island, because they went across there to... replenished. There was an emergency hut over there, so they tried to go over there once a year just to check the stores and the condition. So we took advantage of that, myself and Gordon Picken, who was studying gastropods. He said, why don't we go across in the boat and we'll dive the cove of Coronation and see if it's anything over there. So we just went over and made a dive and didn't find anything particularly different, but it was another dive site ticked off. And with Sirolis as well, we had the means then. The boat was considered big enough that we could do, because we had Sirolis and the backup inflatables on base, we did one or two circumnavigations of the island when it was calm weather. And again, we took advantage of just taking the dive gear and do a quick dive as we went round.
Were you, in fact, finding new stuff? Were you discovering new habitats and new colonies?
Well, it was always, you know, the secret with... The secret when you go diving in the Antarctic is that a lot of the shallow areas, particularly around Sydney, because you get heavy Weddell Sea pack ice every year, the flat areas shallower than 15 metres get a lot of ice scour. The really rich places, you go looking underneath the overhangs of the rocks. And there's one or two really lovely sites. If you go out of Borish Bay and turn right and go along a little bit along that coast there's a wonderful sort of bit of about 50 metres long, which is just a big, deep overhang, and there's lovely soft corals hanging down there and stuff like that. And I think we discovered that site, first of all. There's also an amazing rock called Powell Rock, which is the far side of Borish Bay, and we dived a lot on Powell Rock, and we found some faces on there that hadn't, I don't think, been seen before. Gordon turned up a new species of gastropod on Sydney during his studies. So there were always... The more time you spend underwater, whether it's watching seals or grovelling around, you'll always come across it. I mean, we were there, not the first, but I remember during one winter, I think it was 79 or 80, we were diving under the ice, and I remember distinctly seeing a little group of krill that were... I went close to them and I could see them underneath the three-dimensional structure of the ice. There was little pockets where algae... and gathered and detritus and stuff growing. And I remember seeing this krill in there gathering it up with its feeding apparatus. And I said this to Andy Clark later on when I saw him in the summer or something. And he said, oh, I wonder if... It was the beginnings of how important, you know, the under ice episode in krill's life is, and how there is food underneath them for it, even though the fact that they shrink in size when it's hard. But this sort of thing, you know, you get it all the time, and it's fascinating. There's a great paper that somebody sent me just yesterday, this John Davenport, a scientist in Cork. He looked at underwater emperor penguin footage that I got for Blue Planet, and he noticed how the penguins stream bubbles as they head towards the surface very fast. And he did the maths and worked it all out, and he figures that these bubbles actually make it slide through the water faster. and therefore it can accelerate and make the jump out onto the top. And he's done this paper with all the physics in it. And it's really good being thinking that you're contributing towards little things like that, or just simply your observations open a door. Because I'm always surprised by how many scientists, marine scientists, don't stick their head underwater. Okay. So it's just good fun doing it.
So generally speaking, did you find that the scientists accepted you as an equal with them? That although you were not a trained scientist, your observational powers are the same as theirs? And
do you mean now or when I was with Bass?
I'm talking about the Bass.
Oh, Bass. Well, I mean, all the scientists on base through the winter were all studying for their PhDs, because back in those days, Bass would take graduates with a 2-1 and they would offer PhDs. And some of these students would go down for 2.5 years and do all their field work and then come back to Cambridge, write it up, and at the end they had a PhD. So only in the summer would you get the postdocs down there, people who had their PhDs already and senior scientists, what have you. So it wasn't a case of being, some of them being, me being, I just had the same qualifications as them. And no, I found them all fascinating, and they were a great mix of people, and they all had their quirks, etc. But in the end, you know, but generally we just got on well, and if a scientist just wanted to do his work and no more, that was fine. We'll get the dives over as little as possible. But others of them, I think they welcomed a diver who was willing to go and just take photographs or go and explore new sites or stuff like that. So it's fine.
You did a year up to April 77 and came home.
Yeah.
And then you hadn't been back long when you were...
No, I decided... South again. I can't remember when I decided exactly. I came out in April 77, like you say, and went into South America for 4 months, did the classic long FID trail through South America, and finally got home, I think, about the end of August, having worked my way up through South America to the Caribbean. And I think I either applied to Bass at that point or in good time for the next year. And so they employed me. But I remember saying to Bass, look, last time I got on in Punta, went straight to Sydney, stayed at Sydney until April, came out, maybe went to... I don't think we even went to the Falklands. I think we went straight to Monty, something like that. So I said, if I go down this time, I'd like to go down on the ship. And because I know the score on Sydney, I'd like to get a peninsula trip, do all the reliefs and stuff, and then, you know, what have you. So Bass were really good. They said, fine, no problem, we'll do that. And so I ended up getting... Well, then they decided to make me King Fid on the ship, which was great because it gives you a chance to really know all the people and also know the crew and officers in a different way. So we went down, and I got to go to Halley and do the relief. I got down the peninsula to Faraday for a big relief down there. Didn't go as far as Rothera because it was too early in the season, but basically got to Sydney in the middle end of January, did the changeover, and then did that winter, and then had the following summer. We were going to get picked up last call, but of course that was the famous year when we got stuck.
I'll come back to that again.
I sure will.
You tooled yourself up rather better.
No, I decided that I wanted to do Sydney photographic justice, so to speak. So when I came back when I got back to UK in September of 77, I found that a person that I had trained or had worked with in Jersey 3 years before, in the dive school, he had gone to Germany and was now working for a commercial diving company in Germany. And back in those days, again, to work commercially, you didn't need quite as many qualifications as you do now. So he said, we could do with a hand, you want to come out? So I went out there, and for 6 months, he and I and another German diver, we worked in the freshwater reservoirs and canals of Germany, doing really almost like labouring work. A lot of it was either simple video surveys of damage, you know, stuff that might be damaged, but we also did a lot of concreting, so you'd build the shuttering underwater and get stuff poured in and all that. And I did that for 6 months, and from that, because Bass said, I knew, I think by December, that Bass were happy to take me. And they said, OK, start in June or July and you'll train up the new guys and do all this sort of thing. So in that 6 or 7 months that I worked as a commercial diver, I made enough money that I bought myself a couple of Nikon F2s and housing, and arranged to buy a flash in the States, because we were going over through Jacksonville. That was back in the days when Bass had a contract with the Americans to take some of their cargo down south. So the ship would leave Southampton and went to the States, picked up stuff for the Americans, and then went down to South America. So there was this state-of-the-art electronic flash that you could only get in America. So I arranged to phoned up the shop at great expense, because this was 1977. And when the ship docked in Jacksonville, it was there for 2 days. I drove from Jacksonville down to Miami, picked up the flash and drove back to the ship. And so therefore, when I went south, I had a pretty good setup.
This was an underwater?
An underwater. So I had an underwater housing, underwater flash, 2 Nikon F2s. And really, you know, blitzed the underwater scene and the topside scene too. And I'm still using presentations that I do today. I'm still using photographs that I took in those days. You know, they've been scanned now onto digital. But we had, in 1981 particularly, that's in 1980 in the winter, we had an amazing crab eater seal encounter where, well, maybe you want to go into this later.
Yes,
chronological. You want me to do it just now?
Go on, this bit.
That second winter, the sea ice broke up at one point, and we were left with an ice edge going all the way from Signy all the way across to Coronation, which is about 7 miles away. So on the left-hand side, looking from Signy, was good solid ice. On the right-hand side was open water. And I remember we woke up one morning and about 2,000 crab-eater seals were all hauled out on the ice, all strung out in lines all the way across to Coronation. So this was, I think this happened about August, so the visibility was great, really gin clear. And we were able to snow machine out along this ice and then go in off the ice edge. And all these crab-eater seals would come and swim around about us. So I've got photographs where you can count 28 crab-eater seals all round about, looking at the diver from above. And Rick's down there at one point, he's in a bit shallower water and he's on the bottom. And there's this fur seal just putting its flippers out and just looking at him straight in the eye. And it was great. They were there for 3 or 4 days and we dived with them 4 or 5 times and then they just disappeared like that. So it was a really good chance to get some good photographs. And the photography obviously did come on leaps and bounds because we used to self-process erectochromes down there. So you could do a dive and then by the evening you could see what you'd got and therefore go in the next time with.
You were able to photograph those crab-eater seals because you had been stranded.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell me about the story of April 80, 1980.
April 1980,
ship didn't get in.
Exactly. I can't remember the dates, but roughly, say, about January into February, Bransfield was on her way to Rothera and she hit an uncharted rock and was pretty badly damaged. They had to get divers down from Palmer. They looked at it. And luckily it wasn't holed, but it was severely damaged, bashed. So she limped, said you have to go north. So she limped north to Montevideo and back to UK. And that just left the Bisco down there. And so the Bisco rejigged her schedule. But she was also doing a programme called Offshore OBP, Offshore Biological Programme. So it meant that instead of the Bransfield coming at the end of March to do her final call of summer, the final ship call was scheduled for Bisco around about the 12th of April, I think, as I recall. So at that point, there were 7 of us on Signy who should have been going home on that last ship call. We were a mix of a couple of scientists who'd been on Signy 2.5 years, a Met man from Halley who had come in to service the meteorological equipment, who'd been on Halley for 2.5 years, a couple of scientists who should have been there, only who'd just done a summer and were due to go back to Cambridge, and there was me and I can't remember. Anyway, there were 7 of us. And there were 4 people, I think, 2 or 3, but maybe less. There were a number of people on the ship due to come in. But around about the last week of March, it got unseasonably cold and lots of pack ice started appearing from the south. And it wasn't uncommon in Signy through the summers for pack ice to come, hang around for a couple of days, and then winds would change and blow it away south. But this stuff came and it just hung around. And the temperature started going down, and by early April, 5th or 6th, 4th, 5th of April. The pack ice had been around for quite a while, and we were getting minus 16s, minus 17s, and we could see the stuff beginning to freeze in between. And of course, it was the days before satellite shots, and Cygni wasn't a great place, lousy weather and things, but we would go up on top of the ice cap as often as we could, and we'd look around, and it was just 10/10 to the horizon. But of course, your view to the north is obscured by Coronation, so we didn't know how far north this ice field went. But we were beginning to, we were joking amongst ourselves, saying, ah, Biscoe's going to have some fun getting in through this. And basically, Biscoe, when she tried to come in from, she was working just south of South G, I think, on this scientific programme, she got within about 120 miles and was hitting 10/10 ice, too big for her to push through, in conditions where the leads were freezing and it would have been far too dangerous for her to come on. So she bashed around on she kind of stuck to the edge and made the odd foray into it and was beaten back for probably 5 or 6 days. And then they had to make the decision, look, we could hang around here for a month and nothing might happen. So we got this very good telex in from Dick Loss, which must be on, yeah, Dick Loss, which must be on your files, saying how, you know, I have decided to, you know, in the light of conditions, I've decided to there's no further purpose served in the Biscoe staying where it is, you know. And something about, I'm sure that the people, this will disappoint some people, you'll all rise to the occasion, as Vince probably do. You know, so we sent back something formal. But I always remember the one that came in from the ship itself, from the FIDs on the ship itself, which was just a telex that said, we are going north, we may be some time. To which we telexed back, you bastards, leaving us here to die. And so instead of something like 13 people overwintering, i.e. the 7 who'd gone plus 2 coming, we had an 18 overwintering people. But I have to say that it was just a great year. All 18, luckily, no one was duplicated with their jobs. All the people who had finished their work, like the scientists, Tom, the summer people, they all rose to the occasion brilliantly and chipped in and didn't moan about it or things like that. And because we had a good year for sea ice and because we had extra people on base with lots of experience, we just had an orgy of travelling on Coronation. You know, we were going to places that had never been visited before or hadn't been visited almost since the 57, 58, early 60s when they were doing the surveying over there. We went Coronation, you know, west end to the east end. We did, well, I climbed Mount Sladen that winter for the first time that had been climbed. And we visited a few more peaks which hadn't been done before. And it was just a great winter for travelling and a good winter for sea ice.
You also, I don't know if it was you that fell down a crevasse, but there was a three.
Oh, there was a few.
There were three men that went down a crevasse.
Well, there was. Let me think. Was this three? Oh, that was. I went down crevasses twice on Cygni. once was on Sladen, and that was just me went down. But yes, the other one. Now, was that in the same winter? That was at the back of. We were trying this peak called Wave Peak on Coronation, which is when it's not the biggest peak on Coronation, but it's an easy peak to climb. But we were at the back of the Sunshine Glacier at a place called High Stile, and it was pretty poor contrast. And basically, all three of us started. We were all basically walking along the same bridge, and all three of us went down it. But there was one person. No, there was four of us because one person stayed on the top. Three of us went down, and we didn't fall that far. I won't see. I don't think it was that far. And we all got ourselves out, and it was fine.
Did that feel like a close call? In retrospect,
well, I think, you know, maybe when you haven't, the more you know about crevasses, the more you think back, it would be a close call. Yeah, I think any time you go down, the second one was worse. That one, you didn't have the feeling you were dropping that far and we hit a big snow bridge and everything was fine. I suppose you do think, you might think a little bit, but I don't know, we didn't have that sort of fatalist attitude. We just got on with it and you might think, yeah, well, we were lucky, let's pay a bit more attention the next time. But the second one, that was going up, we were climbing up Mount Sladen and I was leading and we were going up in file like this and I went in one and I remember distinctly falling for long enough that I could see the blue walls going past and then I was caught on the rope And it was, I was hanging there and it went a long way down. And I didn't, you know, but luckily the guys up on top, they were down the slope, so it was easy to arrest me. And I had Jumars and all the usual stuff, so I was just able to Jumar and get out. But that would have been a bad one to have gone to.
Well, the other tricky moments in your Antarctic experience, moments when you saw your life flashing before your eyes?
Well, I've fallen through the sea ice a couple of times. They're not life flashing through your eyes. One of them, I was when I was filming and I stepped into a slushed over Weddell seal hole, and it happened so fast. You always think back to the thing that surprises you when you have an accident like falling down a crevasse or falling through the sea ice. Somehow you always think you're going to get a bit more warning about it, but you don't. You're just bang, you're just there. It's almost like you watch explosions and they always happen in slow motion, whereas they don't, they just boomf. You know, or you an accident with a car, getting hit by a car, you just hit. And if you had any more time, you might be able to avoid it. But anyway, so falling through the sea ice was a bit scary, just because it happened so fast. And then we dropped a skidoo through the sea ice. But that was that kind of had a horrible inevitability about it. we got into an area where we're skidooing, and I had two of us on one snow machine, and the other guy was driving, and we were both pretty aware, pretty looking, but it had been one of these very cold spells and then a little bit of snow, and you can normally tell thin ice because it's a little bit greyer, but this one had just frozen enough on the surface and had a drop of snow on it that it just looked the same colour. But so we hit this bit and suddenly I could just feel, both of us could feel that the tracks weren't quite biting the same, and I looked around and there was a big plume of slush getting kicked up. And we both knew, I said, this isn't good. Give it some, you know, turn it, give it some gun. Let's try and see if we can get out of it. But almost as he turned it, you could feel it slowing down as more and more slush got kicked up. And it was like a slow motion. It just... And as it went and stopped, it was at this kind of angle. And he stepped off to one side and I stepped off to the other side because the ice was just thick enough to take our weight. And we stood there a metre away and watched the skidoo just...
Stem first,
yeah. But luckily it was only over about 10 metres of water, so we, a couple of days later, the ice had thickened up enough that we went up and we could see the area of disturbed ice where it had gone through, and we just dived down and brought it up to the top.
Floated. Didn't work.
Oh, yeah, it was fine, no problem. And... before we lifted it, I've got a great picture of Dave Root sitting on it in a wetsuit.
Underwater,
wrapping it up. And I remember also when George, who was driving it, we obviously walked back to base. It happened off North Point. And neither of us was wet. This was it. We just stepped off. He even took his rucksack off the back. So it didn't go down with anything valuable on it. But we walked back to base and the diesel mechanic, who was also responsible for the snow machines, he had seen us 10 minutes before going out with a snow machine and now walking back. So he said, oh, you had a bit of trouble with it, did you? And George said, yeah, it's okay, though. We just flooded the engine. And left it at that.
What's this story about diving with leopard seals at Cygni?
Oh, yeah.
According to my informant, Ken Richard, you were the first Cygni person to dive with leopard seals.
Yeah, probably. Leps had a... There had been some, I think, come into the cove. I think they had been seen by divers, but there was a lot of concern about leps at that point. And part of it came from just the reputation that they had. But also the Palmer people seemed to have... They did a lot of diving at Palmer. And the people at Palmer seemed to have more issues with leopard seals. Maybe they behaved in a more aggressive manner. I don't think so. But I think... with a lot of hindsight, it's probably just curiosity. But the general procedure, the general protocol in Cygni was to be very aware of them and to leave the water if they appeared or were seen. And I think we were around it. We managed, again, because we had this new, bigger boat, we could dive a little bit further afield. And we went round to the penguin colony at Gourley Point and decided to have a scuba dive there, looking for stuff. And when we were scuba diving, a lep came to us And I think me and the other diver just decided that he seems to be okay. He's just curious. Let's not immediately abandon the dive. Let's just sit and watch him for a while. So we did. And he just swam around us for a while and he seemed to be fine and then left. And I think we tried again. I thought I didn't have the camera with me that time. So I remember So I remember planning to go round again and try for something. But I don't think we got the chance. I think the weather was always lumpy in that corner, so we didn't. But it was the beginnings of my feelings, which eventually, when I left Bass and went into wildlife filming, I fairly soon after that, I got approached by Alistair Fothergill to do this series about the Antarctic, which became Life in the Freezer. And when we were thinking of new things that hadn't been done, I said, I think we could do a good job on leopard seals, because my limited experience with them, I don't think they would. I don't think they're as dangerous as you think. And had you asked me that before the unfortunate accident to Kirsty, I would have said,
Brown.
Yeah. If you'd asked me before, I would have said the same. Now, I have to couch it in the terms that, you know, she was very, very unlucky, but they are big animals, and if they decide to go for you, that's just how they'll take you by surprise. And she just was so unfortunate to meet that lep, and also a lep that took hold of her long enough and took her down and all the rest of it. I think in many other circumstances, you could change any one bit of that unfortunate incident. Had she seen it a fraction of a second earlier, had it been almost any other leopard seal, it might have had a very different outcome.
When you were in the water with the leopard seal, then what was your overriding emotion? Were you?
Oh, I was just excited. You know, we were just. It was just great to have. I mean, we'd done a lot of diving with Weddell seals before then. We went up, we used to go round to the west coast and up to North Point because there was Weddell seals breeding up there. And we used to take people up there and we'd dive with them. We'd find cracks or holes big enough that we'd just drop in, and then we were able to work on anything. And we dive with fur seals as well and stuff like that. So, leps are, you know, they are charismatic seals. They are clever seals. And so to get a close look at one was, it's that classic excitement, something new and something that's potentially dangerous. It's just a great privilege and great excitement. And there's also the bullshit element, isn't that right?
What's all this about playing a fiddle as a Cayley?
I used to play the fiddle. I haven't played the fiddle for a long time, and I kind of sometimes think about taking it up. But yeah, I took the fiddle down to. I was told at Cambridge, you know, about the midwinter celebrations, and therefore, if you can bring any amusement down with you, then by all means do. So I took my fiddle down with me. I think I took it down all the times I was south. But we did have a pretty good Cayley that time, and. I told this joke, this Billy Connolly joke, in which the hero played the fiddle, and I told this joke about a Glaswegian wrestler who was called Wee Shuggy. And amongst some people in Bass, I still get called Shug because of that joke, although Shug is actually Scottish for Hugh. But Shug sounded like Doug, so kind of done. But yeah, and then we had a pretty big Cayley too on the Bransfield one year. I can't remember if it was on the way down or when it was. It was the year that Sue went down with Stuart. You know, Stuart's wife came down. So I think that must have been 1980, because it was the year we had a sea ice relief at Cygne, which I think was December 1980. It was pretty unusual to have to do the relief over sea ice at Cygne. Usually by October into November, the sea ice had gone. And it was very rarely solid enough. But I remember in 1980, that year we got stuck, was a very good year for sea ice. And when the Branny came down, she could nose into the ice and we brought everything ashore. And so it meant relief happened quicker. And so I think we had this big Cayley party after that where everybody got drunk and got chased around by Eric Heathorn and that sort of thing.
Is it difficult to keep a violin in tune at minus 30?
No, I think we played it all inside. We took it outside.
You weren't in an ice cave, you were in
a... Did I play in an ice cave? Maybe Ken's remembering better than me. Maybe I did take it down at one point to an ice cave. If he remembers, then I must have done it. And it probably was bloody cold. It wouldn't be smart keeping it in tune and keeping your fingers going from freezing up.
Yeah.
The one I remember was the midwinter one inside. But we did have parties in the ice cave, because there was an ice cave in one of the glaciers for a year or so. There was, you know, these things are just ephemeral. Obviously, the ice front breaks, and that's the end of it. So
you came away from Sydney after your extended stay,
mm-hmm.
back to the UK, yep. back to Aberdeen University to write up.
They gave me, very generously, gave me 3 months in Aberdeen, because I had done a little scientific project on respiration in gastropods. Because, I guess it took me, I graduated in 73, and it probably took 10 years to decide that I really didn't want to be a scientist. I always kept that as a backup in my mind, so to speak. But and going down and doing that respiration project was my idea, and Bass were happy for it to be done, and I had a supervisor, Dominic Houlihan, up in Aberdeen. So when I came back, Bass gave me 3 months up there to go and write it up. So we wrote it up as a paper, and it came out and all the rest of it.
Were you always intending to return to the Antarctic again, or could the opportunity come as a surprise?
I'm trying to think what. Now, I think it was at that point. I remember Dick Laws saying to me in Cambridge, when I got back from that, as we call it, the enforced winter, which was in, let's see, I got back to Cambridge about May or June 1981. I remember him, before I went up to Aberdeen to write up, I was talking to Dick, and he said, so, is there anything else you'd like to do in Bass? And I said, well, I think I've had a really good time on Cygni, but, you know, the one base that appeals to me is Halley. I've been at Halley to do a relief. And he said, what? I said, yeah, well, there's something about Halley. You know, I said, everybody goes on about it being the real Antarctic. And at that point, I think I also said, it's also the only place where you can get a really good look at emperor penguins. And so nothing, I just laughed about it. So I think at that point, shortly after that, they offered me a summer BC at Rothera. Initially for one summer, but then that was when they were just getting into full-time summer BCs. So it might have been initially one year, but then maybe become something permanent. And I wasn't that keen on it because it was sort of admin and things like that. But then the idea was brought that, you know, would I be interested in Halley BC during the year of the rebuild? And so I said, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. So I rejoined Bass about April or so. When the test rebuild started, about April 82, they had this unique, innovative design with a wooden tube with a building built inside it. And nobody knew if you could actually build this. It was only on paper. So they decided that they would do the company who had put the design in, or who were going to build the pieces for it, were based in Ross-on-Wye. So the idea was that they would do a test build of Ross-on-Wye.
Was this Armco?
No, Armco's the metal stuff,
right?
Which the previous Halley had been made out of. This was a company called Structapply, whose previous experience extended to making fruit bins. And I don't know why, you have to talk to Al Smith, why Structapply were chosen. I don't know where the idea for the design came from. I can't imagine a fruit bin building company. But what they could make was plywood or panels of prefabricated panels of wood with insulation sandwiched between them, industrial type ply on the outside, and build the whole thing prefabricated. So basically, the tubes at Halley were pretty long. I think they were about 30 metres long, and there were four of them, and they were joined with connecting bits. And the four tubes were slightly different, but they could all be made with the same bits. So the idea was that at Ross-on-Wye over that summer, we built all the four tubes. Well, we didn't. We built one tube to see what would work, and then we built the four buildings inside them. And as we built them, we made sure that we had all the bits, that they all fitted together, and we also labelled them. Each tube was colour-coded and had its number, so A3 with a red splash on it in every corner, because we knew that one of the key things to building the thing was it all had to come off the ship as soon as possible, but then it had to get laid out on the snow so that the builders, as they built it, could ask for bits you know, required, so that not too many bits were piling up round about the actual building site. So it was great, and somehow we ended up, I remember that officially, Bass Finances made a screw up, because it ended up that we all, that myself and the four builders who were going to be involved, plus the electrician, plus all the sort of key builder people, we ended up working in Ross on Wye for about 4 months, and we all were staying in hotels, and then we rented a house for ourselves, and we were getting paid as if we were living in Cambridge, and all those expenses were covered. And I think that shouldn't have been that case. It should have been worked some other way, whereby we had a lot less money. Because I think we were given an allowance, but by living in a house, we were always making money hand over fist as well. But it was a really good summer. We had a great time. It was one of those good UK summers, and we got on really well with the structural ply people.
So are we now talking about Halley 3 then? Is that
Halley 4, I think Halley it 4. Was. I think so, Halley 4.
Okay.
And then, of course, it was the biggest load that the Bransfield had ever carried, because it all had to go in Branny. So, and I was, I was into the photography as well, and I offered and was taken up. I said, I think this is a big enough project, we should do a photographic record of it. So I took all the stills of the test construction, and then also took all the stills as we built it, and then through the summer and all the rest. And when I came back after that winter, I worked in Cambridge for a month putting together an AV presentation of it, which is still in the archive, I think. So yeah, it was great. So we went down and we had, it wasn't the easiest of winters, I have to say, because there were some very, there were some very strong personalities on base. One of the chief builder was a guy called Jack Scotcher, who's a great guy. Jack had done 2 winters at Halley, and Jack was at Halley. Jack's second winter at Halley was at the start of that winter, was the winter when Miles Mosley was killed by the plane. And Jack took over Winter BC for that second winter. And Jack was then the chief builder of the building project. And Jack, having been there for 2 winters, Jack knew Halley and knew the difficulties of it, psychologically and all the rest of it. I suppose it's most simply expressed by his leadership style was different from mine. And it was difficult for him because, having been BC for 2 years, he then had effectively to let me do it how I thought it was best. And he had issues. And also, I wasn't a builder. The only thing that I could lead was kind of psychologically. And Jack had problems because not all the builders were as good as he was. And I had a lot of balancing act between sort of saying to the people who weren't so good, look, can you lift your game up a bit and keep Jack happy? And then saying to Jack, look, can you not put these people on something where it doesn't matter too much? Or, you know, look, Jack, you know, you like to work on a Sunday, but these people like to get rat-arsed and you won't see them till 12 or 2 o'clock. You know, that's life. But we've got a lot of work, we should be, you know. And I would say, well, anyway, we kind of got through it. And Jack and I are fine now. We, you know, we've seen each other since, that's fine. But it wasn't easy. But I made no bones about one of the attractions for Halley for me was going up and down to the Emperor Penguins and seeing as much of them as I could. And being BC, you could legitimately commandeer base vehicles to go up and down. And we had a great tractor mechanic who was also interested in going up and down. So that was a guy called Dave. Oh, God.
Don't worry.
Anyway.
You took your camera.
Well, the important thing was I took a movie camera as well.
Was this because, a new departure?
Well, it was, because one of the huge things to come out of my enforced winter was that in January 1981, David Attenborough and a film crew arrived on base from HMS Endurance for about 4 days, I think. Back in those days, obviously, access to the Antarctic was much less easy than it is now. And David had just embarked on Living Planet, the second of his monster series. Life on Earth had gone down brilliantly. Now it was Living Planet. Living Planet was all about ecosystems, habitats. And because of the kudos of the BBC, etc., etc., somebody asking. They were offered a place on Endurance for 3 weeks to go down to the peninsula of South Georgia, you know, just film what they could as they went round. So Signy was on their stops. And so about 3 days, 4 days before they were due to get there, they sent, we had a radio comms with them, can we come ashore for a few days? And do you think we could film some ice fish? So we knew how to catch ice fish. You had to put down a net quite deep. You didn't usually get them below about above about 100, 150 feet. But if you put a net down one night, collected them the next day, they were pretty hardy. You could put them in the aquarium that we had and they'd stay alive. We used to send them home to Cambridge periodically. So we said, yeah, sure, we can get you some ice fish. So they rolled up on base. They helicoptered in, landed. They were made very welcome. Because of the weather being the way it was on Signy, it was an obvious decision that they would stay on Signy rather than go back and forth to the ship every night. The biggest, we had just built, or not long ago, we just built a new dive store on Signy. So the dive shop was pretty big. So I said to them, look, why don't you base yourself in here? You can get the gear spread out, you can dry it. You can get sort of... And I, there wasn't much diving going on, so I said, I'm happy to carry you to where you want and I can drive the boats and I can take you to the best places. So I had a really good time. And in that 3 or 4 days, I definitely saw how good a time they were. But I also, to be honest, I took Hugh in to film this ice fish. And we went off the jetty and it was a typical summer day on Signy, a bit of a slop. Visibility, maybe 7 or 8 metres. And, you know, just 2 months prior, I had been diving 100-foot viz with Weddell seals. And I remember saying, you know, you're in the Antarctic, but boy, you should come here for a winter. This is when you want to do it. But they said, oh, well, that's not possible, is it? And so we had a bit of a laugh about it. But I do distinctly remember carrying away from that meeting with David, thinking, these people are doing something that seems really worthwhile. They're having a great time doing it. Ticks a lot of the boxes that I, you know, enjoy doing, the diving, photography, etc. And then I also realised that while I'd coming to the Antarctic to make a good record of stills, even better would be somehow coming doing it movie-wise. So my thoughts were turning to movie at that point. I also had been given a movie camera for the winter, but it was just a little Super 8 thing, and I'd shot some stuff, but obviously I hadn't been able to process it. So anyway, so I came back and then got into Halley and Emperors and things. I thought, I'm going to take a movie camera down. So I bought a 16mm Bolex, and I spoke to Dick, and he said, well, if you can get photographs of them, you know, it'd be fine, we can use them as well. And I wrote to the same producer, Ned, who had been on, whom I'd met on base, to say I was going down. And he said, well, unfortunately, Living Planet is due for transmission in 83, so you'll be in the Antarctic, so can't ask you for anything. But the fact that you're going, accessing Emperor Penguins is pretty unusual, so I will circulate your letter amongst producers and see if anyone else is doing something. So this producer called Geoffrey Boswell was about to embark on a programme called Birds for All Seasons, which covered birds all over the world. So he said, I met him in London, and he said, OK, well, you seem like a reasonable chap. Here's some rolls of film. If you can expose them, then let's see what you've got. So I took down some BBC stock and some of my own, and basically shot some. And then when I went back afterwards, put them to Geoffrey, and he liked what he saw, and he then asked me to do some research for some other Antarctic material that he wanted. And when I looked into it, I realised pretty quickly that a lot of what he wanted was on Signy through the summer. But the problem was that he wanted early season adelies all the way through to empty rookeries at the end of the season. So, and he wanted snow petrels and pintados and jeeps and various things, giant petrels. So I said, so I pointed this out to him, and he said, bit of a problem. He said, my budget just won't extend that far. And he went away and thought. And then he took the very big step of saying to me, look, you're pretty naive about filmmaking. Some of your Emperor Penguin stuff's okay, but a lot of it was, you know, could be improved. If I get you to go for 2 or 3 days with a cameraman who knows what he's doing, would you be willing to go to Signy? I can't pay you the proper rate. In fact, he gave me 1/8 of the rate that a cameraman should have got. But The only upshot of it was that I did learn a lot from the cameraman. I went down, I spent the whole summer on Signy, got some good stuff, and when that series came out, about 6 months later, the first programme was the Polar programme. And half of it was in the Antarctic, 30 minutes worth. And of that 30 minutes, about 25 minutes was mine. So suddenly I had this perfect, what we call a showreel. Suddenly I had a well-edited soundtrack, David doing the narration. Was it David? Anyway, fully narrated, fully finished product, which I could then take to people. And so I suppose, just to try and leap ahead of myself, it first of all occurred to me about wildlife filming in 81. By 86, I had 5 years it took, in which time I did the Emperor's, I did the extra bit of shooting for Birds for All Seasons. I had decided that I needed better equipment, and by 86 I had also gone to Dick and written up an idea for two films in Antarctic winter, and I'd sold them to Survival Anglia. And by about October 86, I knew I was on my way south in 87 again.